Welcome to 2023 with Agnes Kunkel. In 2020, the world was hit by COVID-19. It was like a time machine. Find out what the world might look like in spring 2023 and how we will need to adapt. 2023, your window to a world beyond COVID-19. Thursday is one of the days Xenia chose to work from her company's office. It is usually nice to see her colleagues and exchange work and life updates together. They chat during the break and keep themselves up to date. Thursday's topic of digital investments was brought up by one of her workmates, Susan. "Couple of days ago, I came upon a really interesting ad for a digital investments platform," said Susan. Everyone starts to talk about the different opinions and fields of online investments. William has been investing online for some time now, and he began to count the advantages of such an approach to investment. "An agent is always there to answer your questions, and all details are at the tip of your finger," explains William. Xenia has always wished to raise her income, or at least save up some money for the future, but she always found it a challenge. But now she is kind of convinced with the arguments her colleagues made. In any case, she's not really going to the bank as much as before COVID hit, and finds the investment options at the bank kind of limited. The options of digital investments are surely wider than those at the rarely visited bank. Later that night, before dinner, Xenia takes Thomas's opinion about the digital investment idea. "Today at work, William mentioned that they had a pretty good experience with digital investments. Do you think it's something that we could also do, Thomas?"
"It depends on which field we invest in. Property, real estate, bonds, mixed investments, and also which platforms we use."
Xenia agrees. "Of course, we need to find a platform that is trustworthy and also easy to monitor and use." Xenia then tells him which platform William uses, and they both decide to search more on that later, as Melanie and Christy suddenly enter, saying loudly,
"We are hungry! Let's put dinner on the table!"
Dr. Ole Rummel, welcome to part 3 of this threefold episode of 2023. After a more general discussion about impact of COVID-19 on central banks in Asia and all over the world, and the possibility of increased influence of big tech companies like Apple Pay, Apple, Amazon, Google, Alibaba, Alipay, WeChat on the financial system in part 2, and the final question, what is a bank? Is it still a bank as we have seen banks since the 12th century in Italy, or do we have to create a new idea about what a bank is and to have now a close look on the so-called fintech and, of course, the problems typically associated with fintech, like we had this big scandal of Wirecard here in Germany. And maybe to lose controlling of these type of companies. So, Ole, what do you think about fintech and COVID-19? Has fintech speeded up during COVID-19?
So I am... I have a bit of a reputation in my office and increasingly also amongst our members. I am very skeptical of fintech companies. So this is my own personal view and not the view of my institution, but I'm happy to share my view, which is that these firms promise a lot and always under-deliver. And this goes back to their particular business model I'll talk to in a minute. You mentioned fintech and COVID-19, and I'm reminded there's a wonderful quote by Warren Buffett, the U.S. investor, who said that only when the tide goes out do you discover who's been swimming naked. And this is exactly what happened now. The tide has gone out. COVID-19 has been a big crisis, and fintech has done pretty poorly. So they've been discovered that they weren't wearing swimming trunks. They were swimming naked, and now the big secret is out. So what I was expecting is for fintech companies to use the COVID-19 crisis to step up and showcase their viability and usefulness. So, for example, in virtual banking, this would be, you know, a digital-only bank. So a bank that does not have any bricks and mortar branches. So, you know, I would have thought that with the lockdown, as bank branches close, the digital services offered by some fintechs would be more in demand than ever. And we've already spoken about the decline in the use of cash, which has been sort of a real benefit to companies involved in the area of contactless payments. But it turns out that even, you know, this sort of super hyped, super dynamic fintech sector is not immune to what happened during COVID-19. So even many of the fintech firms have had to cut staff and cut wages of existing staff. Many of the fintech firms had to pull back spending plans. Many of the fintech firms had to halt any national or international expansion. And many of the fintech firms have had to spend their money very carefully. A lot of them get their funding from venture capitalists in the early stages. So they have they've had to recalculate how long their existing funding might last. It is true that the crisis has changed the financial behavior of consumers quite significantly, but maybe not in the way fintech expected. There's still a very big step between being a secondary virtual bank for basic transactions, i.e. you pay for food to be delivered, you pay for a taxi, you pay for something. But that's very different from becoming a bank that gives out loans, mortgages, credit cards. So that challenge remains as big now as it has always been. The reason for this, I think, is that big tech firms basically, and are being very unkind to fintech firms, I think they have three business models. The first business model is what we in the trade call regulatory arbitrage. So there are certain countries, certain jurisdictions where the rules are not clear cut and the rules allow fintech to enter a market. The rules are either very liberal by accident or very liberal by design. Again, some countries want to be sort of fintech hubs.
Can you give examples what you are mean, especially by these holes in the regulation or whatever?
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, what activities fall under, and we spoke about this in the second presentation, and you mentioned it in the beginning. You know, what is a bank and what activities does a bank do? In general, the rules are fairly similar, but, you know, there are certain, they may not be the same in every country. Yeah. So what is allowed, what a non-bank can do in one country might be different from what a non-bank can do in another country. The second business model, as I see it, is sort of growth at all costs. And the idea here is that you establish yourself as, you know, a snazzy, very sexy company, and then you get acquired by one of the big tech companies. And then after that, you know, you don't care because the founders, they get paid off and they start their next business model. It's only very few companies that really, really think honestly and hard about making finance work better. You know, I really can't see many, I can't think of many fintech companies who really want to make the world a better place. I see most fintech companies as falling into one of the two previous business models. We do something new because, or we do something that's not covered by regulations because we can. So there's a gap in the market and we fill that. And the second one is this, you know, let's grow as quickly as we can. Let's make ourselves a nice target for one of the big tech companies to buy.
And just to ask a question about the first model, model would be to save cost as not to have the burden of regulation, or to do maybe gray or illegal things by being not regulated.
I would say it's a combination of the two, but not the criminal stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a promise of digitalization. It is the case that going digital lowers the costs for many tasks. There could be a cost advantage to doing things online or in a digital manner. Now, in terms of the second point, and we've seen this in other businesses, we've seen this in other branches, you know, if you're quick enough and if you grow enough, regulation doesn't have much choice. And my examples would be, for example, Airbnb. Mm-hmm. Now, technically, what Airbnb does in many countries is illegal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But because they are so big, you know, regulation had to respond to them being of such importance. And the same is true for Uber, for example. Mm-hmm. I know that in many German cities, Uber is not allowed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, in other places, I think the hope is that these services take off to such an extent that regulators cannot afford to ban Uber or ban Airbnb. And I think there may be some of this going on with sort of fintechs, that they come in early, they grow, like Alipay, for example, and at some point that is so big that regulators can't really do anything.
As so many customers are using it for the flexibility and the easiness of use, they will react very, very disappointed to a legislation against these companies.
Exactly, yeah.
When we go to this very prominent case of Wirecard, as you said, you would define Wirecard as a fintech. And as far as I have understood, there is now the perception that Wirecard was earning money by being a payment channel for not legal poker games in the US. And that from the moment that this being a payment channel for poker players in US was shut down, Wirecard drifted away in a more fraudulent scheme. How does this work? How can you miss 2 billion euros? Just... how can it be overlooked that 2 billion euros are missing? That's a big question enough.
I should point out at the beginning that it's still an ongoing case. We don't know all the facts yet, although the more facts we know, the more worrying it is for everyone, including the German regulators.
Yeah.
So I have a first-hand experience with Wirecard because they were big in Singapore.
Yeah.
So before COVID, I used to go to Singapore quite a bit. And the hotel I would stay at, I would always get my credit card receipt, had a big Wirecard sign on it, because Wirecard was the payments system provider that the hotel used for my credit card payment. So they had a very big footprint in Singapore. I think Wirecard is raising a number of issues, starting off with, and this is something I mentioned before, being the darling of the German startup scene or the German fintech, the sort of national champion. You know, it was sort of a source of national pride that Germany had was able to generate a company of the international stature and reputation of Wirecard. So this made it somewhat untouchable for whatever reason for the authorities. The second point, which I always, I mean, this is not unique to Germany. This is, we've seen this in other sectors before, is I think Wirecard was very clever in terms of courting politicians and, you know, being seen with politicians, having access to politicians. And again, that made interference much more difficult. It's also the case that there was, I think, a complete failure of regulators. They really slept on the job, not only in this country, not only in Germany, but in other countries as well. And this may have to do with the fact that some countries are very welcoming to fintech companies. I mentioned a particular country a couple of minutes ago. It's a small country that has a very big banking sector and that likes to be seen as a fintech hub. So what could be nicer than to have, you know, one of the darlings of the fintech sector playing a big role in your domestic economy? There's also the cross-border issue, which always makes things very difficult. In my work experience, we saw this with Lehman Brothers. I remember I was at the Bank of England when Lehman Brothers went bust. And I mean, the first thing that happened is that, you know, regulators blamed each other. You know, the financial regulator in the UK demanded of the financial regulator in the US, you know, why didn't you tell us? You know, when did you know what and why didn't you tell us? And similarly, the US regulator pointed the finger at the UK regulator and said, you know, why didn't you see it coming? There's an incentive for the auditors to maximize their own benefit, which is, you know, sign off on the accounts, hope for the best, but get paid. So it's, you know, it's kind of a thing that everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And then, of course, you have the clear criminal intent of parts of management. And that, I don't know, but maybe also, you know, one or more of the boards, the board of directors not doing their job. But again, this is a sort of incentive question. What's in it for a director of a company? Should they raise an alarm? Is that good for their own reputation?
Many, many sleeping people and too much politics and too much pride of a champion in a certain ecosystem that maybe resulted in this failure. When we think about COVID-19, COVID-19, as I have learned from other sources and podcasts and so on, created a problem for criminals. First of all, when everyone is at home, a burglary is a little bit difficult. Secondly, I guess even the flow of narcotics was interrupted, as when you don't have ships running and airplanes flying, even these logistics go out of the step. And of course, when you look on this very big narcotic business, you have cash on one side and you have to transfer the cash and you have to wash it white and to do money laundering. And therefore, you typically need cash transactions.
Yep.
Do you have any information if this interruption, these restrictions have had any influence on the systems of laundering money, and if it's maybe after COVID increasing, as I have heard that maybe restaurants badly hit by COVID-19 might be more open and vulnerable to accept black money. And there might be other hit industries that might be prey to black money. Have you any ideas, or have you heard about any discussions in your circles how to cope with this problem?
Let me start by saying that I think we've made a lot of progress in terms of combating one, money laundering. And then if I talk to my colleagues, the other is the financing of terrorism. Mm. So they're both lumped together as AML, yeah. Anti-money laundering, and then CFT, which is the counter the financing of terrorism. Just to give you an example, I occasionally have to send, or, you know, whenever I need to send money abroad, there's a way of doing it online. I can do this online, but only up to a limit of 10,000 ringgit. 10,000 ringgit is about 2,000 euros or $2,500.
That's not much.
That's not much, exactly. If I want more, I have to go to a bank branch and I have to fill in four different forms. There is quite an onerous process already in place in terms of, you know, the sort of the anti-money laundering. Of course, this is again up to the particular authorities, the central banks and the governments, and the treatment is not homogeneous across borders. So some governments might be more comfortable with the idea, or some governments may not have the same strict regulations than others. But I think the number of sort of governments that do that is shrinking, and it's sort of more or less well known who these countries are, and they are public named and shamed. But I mean, I think we've made a lot of progress in terms of doing this. Just to tell you an interesting episode for myself. Last time I was in Singapore, half as an experiment and half as sort of a serious point, I was trying to open an account in Singapore because I was looking for, and don't tell this to my Malaysian colleagues and friends, I was looking for a safer place to put my money than Malaysia. So I went to three Singaporean banks to ask whether I could open an account, and all of them turned me down because I did not live in Singapore, I did not work in Singapore, and they could not verify that my money did not come from any illegal activities. I think that's sort of a change from previous practice that didn't answer your question. I'm not aware of any increase in sort of black market activities that I have either heard about or indeed even seen. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist. I actually hadn't thought about some of the problems, some of the issues you mentioned in terms of the supply of certain goods not being available.
It's just from the news, not from more detailed experience. You don't expect that there is something shifting. There is maybe black money flowing in certain industries. You would not expect that.
I mean, again, it's very difficult at the moment. I mean, especially, you know, many countries still have closed borders. So you can't even take a suitcase. Well, you can always take a suitcase out of Malaysia, but it's difficult to bring the suitcase back in. You know, you would have to do it again the old-fashioned way at night in a boat or in a small plane flying to a remote area of Malaysia and then sort of land there. So it's the sort of typical ways. I mean, that's an interesting question. Is that going to change once the borders open again, for example? I mean, by its nature, it's a difficult sector of the economy to measure.
Yeah, exactly. So you would say fintech did not deliver during COVID-19?
No. I think what happened is that those fintechs that have a good business model, those fintechs that have sound finances, will make it through the COVID episode. You know, it's kind of, as we talked about earlier, it's survival of the fittest. So it's those fintech companies that really make finance work for us better, rather than those, I think those fintech companies will have survived and will survive. I think it's sort of the more frivolous, the more those who don't have a business model that have fallen by the wayside and that will fall by the wayside going forward, because they've been found not to be fit or not to be viable.
So you say it's just like the division between the bad ones and the good ones, or the interesting models and the just me too and not so interesting models, and that. As I understood, you say it was not that COVID-19 made this fintechs run, or it was not a push. It's for them a crisis as it was for everyone else.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
That would be my sort of very biased, very subjective, very opinionated point of view.
Yeah, it's maybe as people was concerned about groceries and where to buy food, but it was not about doing more banking business online. No? That maybe was just not a moment where people were open to try new banking models or so.
Yeah, I should point out that the more successful fintechs are those that cooperate with the banking system, that don't try to revolutionize the banking system, that don't try to take the place of a bank. I think the ones that have thrived are those that work together with banks, that provide the interface for the banks. The ones that have thrived are those that get involved in the payment system. Mm-hmm. We can always need an easier way of transferring money, of wiring money, of paying people. And it's those fintechs who have done quite well, but not, you know, sort of the more outrageous ones who want to revolutionize finance as we know it,
Completely.
Who claim to have a much better business model for a bank than the one we've had for the last 600 years.
Yeah, these complete online banks, I guess you are speaking about. Yeah, Ole, that was a wonderful broad picture you were bringing to us. And so
Can I stop you here? Because I am in the flow and, you know, I'm sort of opinionated. Do we want to talk about the US dollar as well?
Yeah, we talk about it. We will talk about on the US dollar. Exactly.
So what is it you want to know about the US dollar?
The question is that we will see some accelerated technological change, and that we see maybe Alipay in Europe, in Germany. Will this accelerated change in the banking world favor or not favor a global leading currency like US dollar?
Let's have a look at the sort of contenders, the currencies that are out there. I've been a big a big fan, a big supporter of the euro for many years. I mean, I wrote my PhD thesis on the euro. The euro just celebrated 20 years last year. It has had its ups and downs. It's had a fair number of quite serious crises. It's kind of established as a global leading currency, but not to the same extent as the US dollar. And that has a lot to do with the euro area or the European Union more generally being a very unique institution that's not always firing on all cylinders. There are frequent concerns about, you know, the future of the European Union, future of the euro area, and so on and so forth, which are weighing down on the prospects of the euro going forward. Just by sheer size, I think the renminbi should be considered at some point a reserve currency. Of course, the problem at the moment is it's not convertible outside of China. That doesn't help renminbi being a leading currency. So what are we left with? We're left with the US dollar. And, you know, again and again, we see that in terms of crises, what do people buy? People buy the US dollar. We saw it in 2007, 2008, during the great financial crisis that started in the US, but the US dollar appreciated. Mm. We've seen it in terms of COVID as well, that in the initial phases of COVID, people bought the dollar as a safe haven currency. So I think sort of any talk of the death or sort of the demise of the US dollar is
premature in some way.
Premature, it's an exaggeration. In fact, one of the issues in the region I live in is that a lot of the companies in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Thailand, in the Philippines, in, you know, wherever you go, they borrow in dollars. Mm-hmm. So you have big corporates in our member countries who are sitting on extremely large dollar loans, mm-hmm. which need to be repaid. We have, despite many attempts by the likes of China and Russia and Venezuela, you know, most of the major commodities, be it oil or be it gold, are all invoiced in US dollars. If you want to convert from the Mongolian Togrok into the South African rand, how do you do this? Well, you first convert the Mongolian Togrok into US dollars, and then you convert the US dollars into South African rand. So in all of these areas, in trade, in commerce, in foreign exchange markets, the dollar plays a leading role. And I think it will continue to do so for a while.
Thank you for this big, broad picture of the world of currencies, monetary systems, banking systems. What might be the benefit for big tech putting a foot into the business of giving loans to other people and all that stuff? It's really overwhelming in any case. And as you mentioned, maybe we will do an update in a few months or so about the topics we were speaking. And in the end, Ole, I always have a personal question. Your personal life was hit very hard. You have not seen your family for 7 months. And this was really, as I understand, a very hard restriction for you. In the contrast, is there a change where you say, okay, I have changed my life in this point that I want to stick to in the next month, years, whatever. So is there a change that was caused by COVID-19 where you say, yes, that's a better way to handle it and I will stick to this personal change?
There is. I have to say that I was positively surprised. I think one of the things I would like to continue to do when this ends is to work from home for 2 days per week. I was very skeptical about home working from home for a long time. And I used to be the sort of, you know, second or third person in the office in the morning and one of the last to leave. But I think I've become very, I don't want to be here 5 days a week or 7 days a week, as we have been for a long time, for all sorts of reasons. I mean, I can't open any windows and I don't have a balcony. And, you know, there were times when I would have killed for a balcony. But being able to maybe, you know, one or 2 days working from home, I think makes for a better work-life balance.
Yeah. You are not alone with this idea that you say, I want to stay 1 or 2 days at home and work from home and not to go to the office. Ole, thank you very, very much. This was absolutely wonderful. And it was a great pleasure to talk to you and to learn so much from you. Thank you from our side.
No, thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure. And to all the listeners, stay safe and stay healthy.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to 2023. To get in touch with us with your comments or ideas, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, just email hello@20-23.earth. You can find even more material, including transcripts of our interviews, on our website at 20-23.earth. Please keep in mind, the content of this podcast is our opinion. We work hard to get our facts right. However, if you find something that can be corrected or improved, please email us at hello@20-23.earth. If you haven't already done so, we'd be grateful if you would subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and there will be springtime in 2023.